space probe has been put in orbit around an asteroid called Eros, NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Spacecraft have flown past asteroids before, but at blistering speeds. NEAR, however, has been creeping up slowly on the Manhattan-sized asteroid, and this morning it fired its maneuvering jets to begin a slow, spiraling trip around Eros. Right now, the spacecraft is about 200 miles away from the asteroid, but it will gradually move closer over the next year. NEAR stands for Near Earth Asteroid Rendezvous. Eventually, it will come within 9 miles and will be able to snap some very detailed pictures. Astronomers want to learn more about asteroids, in part to know how to deflect one if it should head toward Earth. Eros's orbit keeps it at a safe distance from our planet. That's a good thing, considering it's much larger than the asteroid that hit 65 million years ago and caused a global calamity that wiped out the last of the dinosaurs. Richard Harris, NPR News, Washington.
Wall Street, the Dow is up 114. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, blue chip stocks are trying to rebound from Friday's sell-off, but technology issues are not having a rosy Valentine's Day so far. NPR's Doreen McAllister joins us with the latest.
Interest rate-sensitive financial stocks pushed higher as Wall Street looked ahead to a week heavy with economic data. The Commerce Department reported that business inventories rose 0.5% in December and sales rose 1.1% for the month. Wall Street is expecting numbers on wholesale and retail prices this week, which will help economists gauge inflationary pressures and the threat of future interest rate hikes. Viacom has filed papers with regulators to spin off its MTV I Group in an initial public offering that would raise up to $10 million. MTV I encompasses all of the MTV and VH1 websites. And the Zagat survey is getting $31 million from major investors who think the restaurant guidebook can be a hit on the web and on Wall Street. The capital investment is being announced today with a public offering of stock, unlikely until sometime next year. Doreen McAllister, NPR News, Washington.
Microsoft releases its latest computer operating system this week, Windows 2000. The package, which is a successor to Windows NT, is geared toward companies with large networks and complex business operations. A technology consultant group has predicted that 1 in 4 companies may have trouble running software from Microsoft competitors on Windows 2000. That prediction sent Microsoft stock sliding about 5% on Friday. It's up a fraction of a point today. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 114 points at 10,538 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite is up 5.5. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation for reporting on biological resource issues.
Good morning and welcome to Odyssey on WBEZ Chicago 91.5 FM, Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Love is a lucrative business. If you're a florist, a greeting card company, or a restaurant, but is it profitable for our species? Sure, mating and reproduction are important, but those things could be handled in a variety of ways. So why so much fuss about love? Today on the program, we'll hear a rebroadcast of a program on love, how we look for it, what we'll do to get it, and how we benefit from it. We talked with Midge Wilson, a professor of psychology at DePaul University, and Diane Suter, associate professor of biology at Loyola University Chicago. We begin with Midge Wilson talking about how love is studied.
Well, there are a couple of different approaches to the study of love. Most recently, the evolutionary psychologists have been looking at why did love evolve, what function does it serve for the species. Clinical psychologists might explore what forms of love are healthy, what forms are not. Social psychologists tend to look at under what conditions does love occur, and personality psychologists might look at what type of people love in a particular way.
Do we have a working definition of love, at least within psychology?
We look at some of the common properties of it. It tends to occur very rapidly. There's a robustness or fullness to it. It's defined by intense preoccupation with another, deeply felt desire to be with them, feelings of incompleteness, things that probably any person on the street could say, yes, that's what being in love is all about.
Would you say, from a psychological perspective in terms of the body of knowledge, would you say that love is as well defined and well understood as other emotions?
Probably because we don't understand the other emotions that well. But there is something that seems more mysterious about love. Mm-hmm. I'll grant you that.
Diane Suter, from the perspective of a biologist, what does biology bring to the table when we're talking about love?
In terms of some of the issues that Midge has just addressed, I think that biologists really haven't started to study love yet as much as perhaps they have studied certain other emotions. If you look in the scientific literature and look at emotion, you'll find a lot of studies from the biomedical perspective on issues like aggression, emotions like aggression, jealousy, and yet you won't see nearly as much in the literature on the emotion of love, and I think we just really haven't started to study that that aspect of our personalities yet from a biomedical, biochemical, evolutionary perspective.
Do you think that that will happen?
I do think that it will happen. It's an emotion that is as scientifically legitimate as any of the other emotions that we do study, and so it is as amenable to scientific study as any other emotion is.
Okay, well, now certainly our love is... we're talking about romantic love today, so that's in the context of mating and reproducing, and biology has a whole lot to say about that, certainly. What does biology have to say about human behavior in this area, I guess what I'm asking is, what is problematic about bringing a biological perspective to looking at human behavior?
One of the groundwork areas in biology, one thing that I think most biologists will say that they study at some level is evolution, studying how things got to be the way they are and what role genes played in getting things to be the way they are is one of the most important aspects of studying biology. And it is difficult to study human beings in that way because of some of the obvious limitations that we have in studying, in setting up experiments and using the scientific method to study humans. So if we want to ask questions about some aspects of mating behavior in humans, what we often end up doing is falling back on looking at mating behavior in other animals, and particularly in our close relatives, the other primates. So we can look at other animals and ask questions about how do females make choices about mates? What are the different patterns of mating behavior? We see what animals are monogamous, what animals are not. What role does infidelity play in mating strategies in other animals? And we can make an attempt to extrapolate that to humans. But in the end, animals, any given species is that species, and humans are humans, and there's a limit to what we can learn about humans from extrapolating from other animals, and there's a limit to the experiments using the scientific method that we can do on humans because of ethical concerns.
Well, when we look at other primates, in particular primates that are closely related to humans, what do we find?
If you look at non-human primates and ask what sorts of mating strategies are employed by them, what you will find is that they are all over the map in their mating strategies. For example, if we look at one of our closest relatives, the gorillas, we find that they live in small harems where primarily two males, a large socially dominant silverback male, and another male, a younger and often related to the silverback male, are the only two males in the group that mate, and that they control the territory and a group of female gorillas so that only those two mate. If you look at another species that is even more closely related to us, the chimpanzees, and in fact the chimpanzees are more closely related to us than they are to gorillas, the one species of chimpanzee that most people are most familiar with live in medium-sized groups that have both males and females, and everybody mates with everybody else. All the males mate, all the females mate. Females may show some level of preference for certain males in the group, but they mate with many, if not most, of the males in the group. There is a second species of chimpanzee that is a little less familiar because it's a very small group called the pygmy chimpanzee, also called the bonobo chimpanzee. They live in only a small area of Africa in the Congo, what used to be called Zaire. And these animals live in small groups, and not only does everybody mate with everybody else, but they do it all the time for every conceivable reason. Bonobo chimps have sex with each other to say hello. They have sex to say goodbye. They have sex to say good morning. They have sex to say, there's one piece of food over there and it's not enough for both of us, but let's not fight about it. Males have sex with males. Females have sex with females. Sex plays many roles, and the levels of social interactions that we might look at and interpret as friendship, companionship, or love, or some degree of that, is expressed in physical companionship at every conceivable level.
So it's difficult to know what to think about, or how to make draw conclusions about human behavior from what we're seeing in primate behavior. Just, it's up in the air what might be considered a natural mating pattern or organization in terms of reproduction for human beings, and analogizing from primates.
I think that what we can know is that for every species, our behavior, and in this case our mating behavior, is somewhat constrained by our biology, but that there are also a tremendous range of potential behaviors that we can choose from. And so to say that one pattern of human mating behavior or mate choice is natural versus learned would be a very difficult question, if not an impossible question to answer, at least from the biological, methodological perspective.
So we'll turn to psychology, since we have a psychologist here with us as well. We're speaking with Diane Suter, Associate Professor of Biology at Loyola University Chicago, and also Midge Wilson, Professor of Psychology at DePaul University. Midge, what can psychology bring to bear on this question about what is, I guess, a natural tendency in humans? Questions like monogamy and lifelong bonding, those sorts of things. Can we learn about those sorts of things from psychology?
I think we've made some progress starting to understand what is entailed in romantic love. For example, the role of arousal appears to be significant. And with studies with humans, we can manipulate the presence or absence of arousal in a number of different ways. And the source of the arousal can vary, but when a person is in an aroused state, for example, through exercise, through watching a scary film, through listening to a comedy tape, and then they're asked, and this was a study that was done with male participants, they were asked to then look at photographs of highly physically attractive women or women that were low in physical attractiveness, and there was a control group that did not exercise or did not become aroused. And they found that those that were aroused had an exaggerated response to the high PA or physically attractive females. So there's something about arousal that fuels the tendency to label feelings as lust, to want to be attracted to another.
But is there any way to know, or is there any way, I guess I'm phrasing this question wrong. Psychologically, does there appear to be a tendency one way or the other in terms of monogamy versus polygamy or lifelong bonding? I mean, obviously we hear about studies about the benefits of being married, you know, people who are married live longer, fewer health problems, those sorts of things. But, I don't think it's clear what the causal connection is. But is there any indication from psychology about whether there's a natural tendency in one direction or the other?
Well, the evolutionary psychologists who look at the role of evolution and argue that to understand human behavior without looking at its biological underpinnings makes no sense, would say that falling in love is good for the species. It's going to promote reproduction and survival of the species. So there are tremendous mechanisms at work within the brain that have probably been selected and retained over the years to make us lust after others. There's some evolutionary psychologists that theorize, and that's really all we can do, that this mechanism of intense attraction emerged as something that would be so powerful that would overcome fear of strangers. Because what was happening, perhaps, millions of years ago, that there were these small clans that were mating with each other, and we know what happens when gene pools get over-contaminated with each other. So they needed to mate with others from other clans in order to improve genetic diversity within the species. So this feeling of intense attraction evolved to overcome the natural or previously normal fear of strangers that existed.
What about evidence from either biology or psychology about what people are looking for in a mate, what they're drawn to, what properties or characteristics they may be selecting in a mate. What do we know about that?
From a biological perspective, we know that female animals do choose mates. It is very difficult, again, to figure out exactly what they are choosing, what basis they are using to choose. Some species we know more than others. For example, there's one of the most common birds in the world is a bird called the red-winged blackbird. Everybody sees them every spring. They're medium-sized, shiny black birds with the males have red epaulets on their shoulders. And in that species, the females don't choose the male at all. They really couldn't care less, as near as you can tell from watching them, which male they're mating with. What they do is they choose a territory. The males come back north in the spring first and establish a territory, and then a few weeks later the females arrive, look around not at the males but at the territory, find the territory that they think has the best resources, the best camouflage, and will settle down and mate with whatever male happens to be there. So in that case, a female is choosing not based on the characteristics of the male body or behavior, but rather on the territory that he happens to be defending. Some species seem to be choosing for particular physical characteristics, and most sexual dimorphisms, sex differences in body shape or color or size that we see, seem to be due to female choice of males that have particular characteristics. But why they're doing that is a mystery. There are two main theories. One theory says that female choice is an utterly random and not particularly practical event where a female just happens by random chance to be attracted to some particular feature. The standard example is a large showy tail on a male peacock. And so the males that happen to have the larger or more showy tails will get the female mates, and then the offspring will have both traits. They will have the genes for the male trait and they will have the genes for the female preference for that trait, and so by virtue of combining the two traits together, the physical characteristic and the female preference, the offspring propagate throughout the species quite rapidly this female choice, to the point that the male characteristics, the bright red color of a cardinal or the showy tail of a peacock, become extremely exaggerated, even though they serve no advantageous purpose whatsoever, other than the fact that females like them, and in fact could be detrimental because it takes energy to make those tails, and it's hard to hide when you're bright from predators when you're bright red. The other theory says that the particular physical characteristics that a female is choosing for, this is called the good genes theory, the particular physical characteristics that the female is choosing for are somehow correlated with good genes. For example, a cardinal's bright red color may not serve any particular purpose, but it may be correlated with a good immune system that keeps him free from parasites that would otherwise give him not quite as attractive, shiny, healthy-looking feathers, and so that she uses that bright red color as a marker for general good health. Those are the evolutionary theories that are out there that explain why females choose the way they do. In humans, it's hard to tell.
Is there any tendency in nature, one way or the other, over in terms of whether the female makes the choice of mate or the male makes the choice of mate?
Evolutionary theory says, by and large, females will all conceive, and that males will not all necessarily conceive, because the female is sort of the limiting factor here. She's the one that makes the expensive gametes. The eggs are sort of energetically thought to be more expensive than sperm. In the case of mammals, she's the one that puts in the tremendous energetic input of pregnancy and lactation. So since she is the limiting factor, theory says that she should be able to conceive whenever she is physiologically capable, and that males will only be able to reproduce when there is an available female. And since the females are the limiting factor, they should be, by rights, the ones that choose. There is evidence that males also choose which females they're interested in. For example, you can do a laboratory experiment where you It's called a T-maze. You put a male rat in a maze that has just two arms, a left arm and a right arm, and you put a different female at the end of each of the two arms, and you can show that any given male rat will readily go and copulate with one or the other of the females, but a given male will more often choose one female over the other female. And then if you go back down to your animal room and get a different male, you may discover that that male prefers the other female. So even in rats, there isn't a absolute biological standard of attractiveness, but males do show preference. Just as sexual dimorphism with aspects of showy colors in males and big manes on male lions are thought to be evidence of female choice, so are certain female characteristics that males don't have thought to be a measure of male choice. For example, among all the primates, human females are about the only ones that have rather large pendulous breasts. And they clearly, that anatomy clearly is not necessary for lactation. Most mammals lactate perfectly wonderfully without that physical characteristic. But human females have it, and it is thought that because it's not necessary for reproduction, and yet it is there and is quite different between males and females, it's thought that evolutionarily that may well have been the product of male choice of mate.
Midge Wilson, now we turn for some psychological input. What can a psychologist tell us about how people go about choosing a mate?
Let's talk about the role of physical attractiveness in humans. Evolutionary psychologists would say that this serves as some sort of index of genetic health, so that males might use that in their selection of females. And there's all sorts of research that shows that males use physical attractiveness more in their mate selection than females use it when picking a male mate. But there are also all sorts of other interpretations of that, like who gets to be more frivolous in making that choice, who has more power in the relationship, and generally men do in this country and most other places. But physical attractiveness doesn't work in terms of the more attractive an individual is, the more someone will want to mate with them. There seems to be a matching hypothesis going on, so that there's been some studies that have looked at if you could be paired with anybody, and you show individuals a lot of different photographs, or they have a chance to go on a date with someone, different people, that they won't necessarily choose the person of the highest PA because they know that they might be rejected by them if they're not so physically attractive. So the most common predictor of who will be attracted to whom is similarity. So we have similarity in physical attractiveness, we have similarity in educational levels, in socioeconomic status, in religious background, attitudes. So we don't just fall in love with individuals randomly.
So is there evidence, though? Well, I don't know if you would even find it in psychology, but it can't be all in our heads in terms of attractiveness. I mean, there has to be some meeting ground, doesn't there, between the biological need or desire to mate and sort of all the psychological input that we bring to it.
Well, I think cultures vary on how much they allow the body to rule, if you will, versus the head. In our culture, we see romantic love as a valid basis for marriage. In a lot of other cultures, people work very hard to keep young people apart because they know there's potential for romantic love to blossom. And in those cultures, the parents believe that they know better, so they have arranged marriages. In that culture, I would say they use the head more in making these mate selections.
So from a psychological perspective, does romantic love depend on or derive from physical attraction? I mean, they're not separable?
I think
most people experience them together,
right.
But people might have a different attitude about, which came first.
It is difficult to tease apart which came first. Obviously, physical attractiveness plays a role, but we also have people falling in love with each other over the internet, and they never saw each other just from verbal, not even hearing the voice, just written interactions. So there's something else that can fuel, and it could be fantasy. Some of the studies have looked at the difference between liking and loving and found that in addition to the presence of arousal that's associated with love, there's also a lot more fantasy generation. So you imagine maybe the person is really good looking and your ideal mate.
Mm-hmm. And so you sort of fill in the rest of the stuff
right.
you'd like.
Right.
What about the idea that I hear expressed from time to time that love is entirely a cultural construct and that there have been whole societies that thrive and do quite well without anything like the romantic love that we believe we have, at least in our society here in America in the 20th century?
There's some debate about how universal romantic love is. There are those that believe that it does exist, or the potential for it to exist occurs in every culture across time. But there are those that say that some cultures just are kind of baffled by the concept, but it's unclear whether or not that's an attempt to suppress it because it's seen as not very productive in mating.
That was Midge Wilson, professor of psychology at DePaul University. We've also been listening to Diane Suter, associate professor of biology at Loyola University, Chicago. Our conversation will continue in just a moment, but because today's program is a rebroadcast, we won't be taking any calls. This is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to WBEZ, Chicago.
The following is a public service announcement provided by WBEZ. If you're 55 years or older, enjoy talking with children, and have about 3 hours to spare each week, why not consider becoming a volunteer for the Grandma Please Chat Line? This unique program links older adults with latchkey children for conversation, comfort, and friendship. To find out more, you can call 773-525-0395. This is WBEZ Chicago.
What's your most important life decision? Career? Where to live? What about the person you spend the rest of your life with? A pair of professors thinks we've forgotten the importance of courtship, and they're eager to reintroduce the notion of romantic love into modern life. I'm Melinda Pencava. Does courtship need to be revived? Join us this Valentine's Day on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Listen for Talk of the Nation weekdays at 1 o'clock on WBEZ Chicago.
You're listening to Odyssey on WBEZ Chicago 91.5 FM, Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Today's program is a rebroadcast of a conversation about love with Diane Suter, Associate Professor of Biology at Loyola University, Chicago, and Midge Wilson, Professor of Psychology at DePaul University. Our conversation now continues. I wanted to ask about the connection between romantic love and other types of love, love of a parent for a child, love among other family members, love of friends. How are they related?
It's curious that we have this one word to cover so many different kinds of relationships. But romantic love should be distinguished from companion love or maternal love and the other kinds of loves that you named. Romantic love is this very energizing, high arousal, mental preoccupation kind of state, and it can't last, some people say, longer than 3 months. That doesn't mean that love goes away, but that kind of intensity just burns out. And again, evolutionary psychologists would say, because you cannot be productive and do the other things you need to do to survive, to stay in that high intense state, so you eventually turn it into companion love, or the relationship breaks up. And there is a 3-month point that has a higher frequency of breakups than after that or before that.
Really? Yeah. So right around May 14th, we should just consider a general increase in productivity, relaxation, yeah. all around. I was reading an article recently, it was a U.S. News and World Report about love, and it said that mother love, a love of a mother for her child, is the basis of all other types of love. Does that make any sense to either one of you from your perspectives?
There are psychologists that look at attachment as an expression of love, and that does go back to the way a child formed its attachment to the mother. And those theorists suggest that when you're an adult, you're looking to sort of duplicate that pattern because it was familiar, your first experience with love.
I think that biologists would tend to agree with that. There is a certain amount of evidence that the mother-child bond does form the basis for a lot of later behavior. For example, there was a classic study that was done on rhesus monkeys back, I think, in the 70s, where infant rhesus monkeys were given the choice of associating with either a plain wire mesh model of a mother monkey complete with nipples and a milk supply, versus a soft terry cloth covered wire image of a female monkey that had no food supply but was softer and cuddlier because of this terry cloth cover, and found that the baby rhesus monkeys preferred to spend as much time as possible with the soft, cuddly mother model, going over to the wire model only occasionally to get food. So suggesting that the physical bond was very important and innate, because it was shown in these extremely young rhesus monkeys. But another interesting aspect of that study was that they found when these rhesus monkeys that were reared in that way as babies grew up, they had a very difficult time becoming mothers themselves, because they theoretically, because they had not had the complete experience of interacting with the mother when they themselves were babies.
So you mean they had difficulty rearing their young?
Right.
Not difficulty conceiving?
Not difficulty conceiving, but once the young were born, they sort of didn't have the slightest idea what it was they were supposed to do with them.
Let's talk with Shane. Good morning, Shane.
I have a comment basically about romantic love and our culture being the basis for marriage. I guess my comment or even question is, don't you see that as the cause of a high divorce rate? Because it seems like individuals are responding to their physiological attractions for one another without, going through a head process, like you mentioned before, of interviewing the person, checking their values, their mores, what's important to them, their perspective. So once that attraction develops so deeply, and they're in that romantic relationship, then they get married, and then they realize that their values weren't congruent. So don't you see that as a basis for the high divorce rate that we have, because people are so quickly jumping into situations without using their head?
Well, that is a criticism that's often leveled against our society, and perhaps why we have such a high divorce rate in comparison to countries, let's say India, where there are arranged marriages. But there's so many other differences between our country and these other countries that employ the parents, you know, making the match, that I'm not sure that we can safely conclude that. For example, women in our culture tend to be employed, they have more economic independence, and they can choose to leave a bad relationship. We don't have laws that prohibit that. That's very good for women that are in abusive relationships. In other cultures where there are arranged marriages, we don't know too much about the happiness of some of those marriages. We just know they last because they have to.
But it would seem that, I think Shane's point is sort of interesting, because it seems like marriage and child rearing is such an important part of anyone's life and takes up so much of their time that you'd think we'd develop strategies to be more pragmatic about it. And maybe, I guess, Mid, you're sort of suggesting that we do in terms of choosing a mate based on similarities and a perceived appropriateness of that mate for us, rather than on, perhaps more ephemeral qualities like physical attractiveness. But we don't seem to be doing a very good job.
You probably not, but there are those that would argue that, again, from the evolutionary psychology perspective, that relationships are not really supposed to last, that this is an artificial institution, that of marriage. The notion that we are to mate for life is one that's the sort of constraint, and now that we live so long, much longer than we used to, that it's unreasonable to believe that you're going to love the same person for your entire life. So, there's lots of debates about that too. But again, going to the evolutionary psychologists, they say that the companion kind of love that may take place after the 3-month romantic love period is up may last only 4 years, and that correlates to how long the human infant may be dependent on its, greatly dependent, they may be dependent for 18 years or more, but greatly dependent on the parents to survive, so that at that point it's kind of time to move on.
There's also some evidence in the non-human primate literature that suggests that humans aren't the only ones that don't seem to do what would make sense or what would seem to be good for us. For example, as we were talking about earlier, evolutionary theory would predict that females ought to be very careful and very choosy about who they mate with, because of the large investment that female is going to make in providing energy and lactation for the developing young. And yet when we look at many primate species, what we see is that the females are not nearly as choosy about who they mate with, not only in humans, but in other primate species as well, doesn't fit that evolutionary theory about what a good choice for a mate is.
Shane, are you still there? Are you there?
Yes.
Would you want to try marriage any other way, though?
Well, this is what, I have a theory that is sort of a bridging of the head and the heart. You develop a model of friendship where you're not dating, because I see that as a premature pseudo-commitment, but you're friends with this person and you're friends with other people. And after you've gone through a long process of getting to know them, their values, who they are, what they like, seeing them under pressure, then you're at the point where you can decide, this is the person I want to spend the rest of my life with. Once you make that decision, you propose. Instead of going through this long process of boyfriend and girlfriend breaking up, which teaches you how to be pretty much divorced before you're even married.
Well, you know, that sounds really practical, but it doesn't sound too much like the experience of very many people I know. Most people I know say they knew they were going to marry the person they married within about 10 minutes of meeting them, and there was nothing they could do about it. You know, that they met the person and they didn't get married, they didn't make the commitment right then, but they just knew that that's where they were headed.
I think there are many different routes to romantic love and how we choose our mate. One of them is like what Gretchen just said, that some people do say, I knew within minutes that I met this person that this was the one. Others are friends with a person for a long time, and then one day they look at them in a different light and suddenly they realized, after all that time, oh, this is the one. So, and there are other, you know, variations to that as well. Your theory is good, but we have to account for all the other variations.
And we have to take actual people into consideration. I don't seem to make those sensible decisions. But, you know, we did a show recently on The American Family, and just about everyone on that show said, we need to teach people how to be married better, how to get married better, how to make their marriages last. So maybe that's what we need to do. Shane, thanks very much for your call.
Thank you.
Let's talk with Larson. Good morning, Larson. You're on WBEZ.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Yes, hi. I have a question I think that might be clearly exemplified by the phenomena of trophy wives. I'm speaking now of people like Aya Coco and Bill Gates. And traditionally, we've seen women in terms of evolution selecting mates based on physical prowess, able to hunt, strength, power, that type of a thing. And now, as we enter the computer and the technological area, are women going to be looking more for people of a physical stature where it's diminished extraordinarily, not to pick on Bill Gates, but that the intellectual capacity of the person and their power to manipulate the environment will become far more important to them? And I'll hang up and let you answer.
Okay, thanks for your call, Larson. What about that? What about the idea that women are now going to be looking much less at physical attractiveness and more at other attributes?
I have a problem with that. Just because I think that we're assuming that there's a equal starting point between the sexes, and a lot of the research that's done by evolutionary psychologists is confounded by power differences between men and women and in the cultures they study. So if we could imagine a technologically advanced culture where women were in the positions of power and headed virtually every institution, there might be quite conceivably situations in which young stud boys were chasing after the older female CEOs. I think we just have to be very careful about making those kinds of inferences.
Plus, I think we have to be careful about extrapolating from the extreme examples of maybe Bill Gates and Lee Iacocca. I don't think Bill Gates is a trophy wife. I want to defend
Mrs.
Gates.
Yeah, I don't
just
think she's a trophy wife either.
there are trophy wives, but I don't think she's one of them. Diane Suter, let me ask you a question. Is there evidence from other species, evidence that love, romantic love or something like it, exists in other species?
The best we can do to understand emotions in other species is to look at the way they behave. Scientists, I think in general, would agree that we cannot know whether animals have consciousness, and if they do, we cannot know what their subjective experience of any given state of consciousness is. So what a biologist can do is look at the way an animal behaves and try to make inferences from that. For example, many species of birds do mate for life, and they often live in particularly during the breeding season, they live in gigantic flocks of thousands upon tens of thousands of birds. We know that these birds who can that mate for life are capable of picking their mate out from among that huge flock of birds that, for all intents and purposes, look completely identical to us. We know that in some cases, when one member of a bonded pair is injured or killed, we can see a behavioral response to that event on the part of its mate. The surviving mate, if the body is present, may hang around the body, poke at the body a little bit. If the surviving member cannot find its mate, we know that they will exhibit behaviors that we would interpret as distress, flying around, searching, calling, with to our human eyes what we perceive as an affect of distress or of missing that individual. Again, that's from a scientific perspective. If you want to try to avoid the anthropomorphism that scientists try to avoid, that's about what we can say. So I would say, yes, it seems like there is some behavioral manifestation of a real attachment in those animals.
What about the early phases of romantic love, the sort of heightened excitement and the desire to be with the other person, those sorts of behaviors, distinct from the sexual attraction? Do you see anything like that in animals?
In some non-human primates, there certainly are what appear to be friendships that are established, friendships between members of the same sex, friendship between members of opposite sex. Sometimes during the breeding season, an experience that humans don't have the way other species do, but many non-human primates experience a breeding season where sexual mating only takes place at certain times of the year, sometimes only for a few days, and you can see some of these opposite sex friendships develop into a sexual relationship during the season of mating and then return to a friendship relationship when the breeding season is over. As a matter of fact, you can also see some of those sorts of behaviors manifest between members of the same sex, where same sex friends will mate with each other during the mating season as well as mating with members of the opposite sex. There are some examples of exclusivity of same-sex mating, although not many, in primate research.
Can I just add that we've been making fairly heterosexist assumptions about all men and all women, and there is some interesting research on gays and lesbians, which indicates that there are more similarities than differences between lesbian couples, gay couples, and heterosexual couples, that in both cases they want minimal conflict in the relationship. They want their partner to appreciate them. They value attachment, intimacy, affection, and respect. So a lot of times these behaviors, we like to link them to reproduction, but there may be other things that are going on to drive two people together that we still maybe don't fully understand, but I think we should continue studying.
All right, let's go to the phones again. Let's talk with Kate. Good morning, Kate. You're on WBEZ.
Yes, my comment or question pertain to friendships between people of the opposite sex. And when you have strong, you love someone very much as a friend, yet you're physically attracted, and when does that cross over into being in love with that person? I mean, I don't know. Just
no, I think that's a good question. Social psychologists have looked at three stages of falling in love, and one is the stimulus phase, and that has to do with how physically attractive you are to the person. And the next is the value stage, and that's when you explore whether or not you have similar attitudes and all the other dimensions of similarity that I mentioned earlier. And then the third stage has to do with how well you play roles with each other, how well things mesh or are interdependent. Some people, we kind of stop at that value stage and we realize this person is going to stay a really good friend. They are other gender, but it's just not going to happen. They're a dog person, I'm a cat person, they're an extrovert, and I'm an extrovert too, and maybe I need to be with someone that's less like that. So there is an element of complementarity of roles that comes to the surface later on. So I think it's helpful to kind of, you know, look at those different phases.
You know, and people seem to find that transition from friendship to romantic love more threatening than romantic attachment that starts out as a romantic attachment. I think people worry a lot more about a friendship turning into, or have more anxiety about a friendship turning into a romantic relationship. Is that just because, well, I mean, I have my own theories,
okay,
but you're
the
psychologist.
Okay, let's hear your theory.
Well, the dangers of being rejected by that person, you know, there's a lot higher consequences of having, you know, someone you think really likes you a lot than say, well, I don't like you that much.
Right.
That's a lot more painful than someone you barely know. But it's
not to mention the risk of losing the friendship.
And the risk
original
of losing
friendship.
The friendship. But is that, why do you think people have more stress about that? Or is that true?
No, I think you answered the question that it would be, yeah. I mean, I think anecdotally we can say that. I don't know of any research that would confirm that, but it certainly makes sense.
Okay, well, Kate, thanks for your call. Let's talk to Berta. Berta, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Very interesting show.
Thank you.
My comment is that, you know, as I was mentioning before, to the man that answered, I have been married for 45 years. I come from a country from Latin America. And when I married this man, was because he had all the qualities that, without ever my parents telling me, he had. He had a career. He was from my same, you know, class status. He was honorable. There wasn't that much of a physical attraction, but for me, he was the perfect mate. And it was not, you know, then later, you know, we married within a year. I fell in love with him as we married, and I think that is the most important thing, that we have been in love for 45 years, and we have had our ups and downs, and we have done a lot of work to make our marriage work, but I think that the commitment that we made to each other without ever expressing it verbally, and the love that we developed through the years is the most important thing. And
this caller's comments reminded me of a study that I looked at just the other day that compared qualities that young teenagers or early 20-somethings consider to be important in mate choice, and did a study of young U.S. Americans and young Mexicans, and showed that there were some differences between those two cultures in what young people consider to be important in mate choice. And one of the differences that I recall is that physical attractiveness and financial status seemed to be of more importance to young U.S. Americans than they were to Mexicans. And so I think this is an example of how different cultures raise their children to develop different values, and that those different values play a role in mate choice.
So, Bert, if you think that a successful marriage isn't necessarily the outgrowth of love, it's something that if I understand what you're saying, it was getting married that made you fall in love.
Well, you know, I thought, you know, let me tell you, I have when one of my daughters asked me after, you know, many years of marriage, when she became a teenager, she asked me, were you in love with my dad when you married him? And it was like a shocker, because I had never really thought of that way. I thought I was in love with him. And then I had to say, you know, I couldn't answer right away. I had to give it I said, let me think about it. And then I thought about it, and I said, you know what? I was not really in love. I fell in love with him later, you know, during the process of the marriage. And I'm not telling, you know, I always loved him, but in love was just something that came later, you know, in life.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like a shocker when she asked me this, because I was very young when I got married, and I just knew that this is the one thing that I had to do.
Yeah, I think your daughter's question reflects what Diane was saying about cultural differences.
Exactly.
She's now absorbed, you know, the American values of using romantic love as a basis for marriage. But I do want to say congratulations on the longevity of your relationship.
I know, but
it's hard work.
It has been work. And you know, living in this country, you know, for 30-something years, it has been a process, because I married when I was very young, as I said, and then I became a person, which for 17 years I had been a wife and a mom. And then I became a person, and that was a shift a total shift in our relationship, but luckily, you know, we were able to work it out because it would have been like the end of it when I became a real an individual, and my husband was totally like, "What happened? You know, this person." But we made it work. So,
well, congratulations.
Thank you.
And have a happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Bye.
Let's try to fit one more call in. Let's talk with Bob. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. My question has... Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Went to bed there for a minute.
We're listening to you.
The echo canceling is working great. My question has to do with teenagers, and we talk about animals going into heat. And it seems... I hear anecdotal tales about people that say... The girl says this is the first time she did it, and she got pregnant. And I'm wondering if there is a biological, quote, hormone-type reaction, which in animals we call being in heat, that causes a girl's, or even boy's, inhibitions to be reduced to where they will have sex when they shouldn't have it, and maybe it's matter over mind or something.
The answer is yes, there are strong hormonal influences on human sexuality as well as on animal sexuality. Mammals can be divided into two groups, those that ovulate on a regular basis every so many days, regardless of what they do, and those that ovulate in response to mating. Animals that ovulate in response to mating are called reflex ovulators. Cats are reflex ovulators. I can't think of any others off the top of my head, although there are certainly quite a few of them. Rabbits are reflex ovulators, but most mammals are called spontaneous ovulators. They ovulate every so many days. Humans are spontaneous ovulators. They ovulate every 28 days, approximately, give or take, regardless of their sexual activity. Okay, now one point that Bob brought up is the issue of a young teenage girl coming home and saying, "I only did it once and I got pregnant." There is some suggestion that ovulation in humans may possibly be movable a few days one way or another based on sexual activity. So by and large, we ovulate every 28 days regardless of our sexual activity, but there is some suggestion that we can shift our ovulation in response to sexual activity, and which would then increase the chances of getting pregnant after only one sexual contact.
But does ovulation stimulate sexual desire?
In most species, absolutely, 100% yes. In humans, there certainly does seem to be some correlation between the time of ovulation and sexual interest. There's a hormone called estrogen. It's present in high quantities around the time of ovulation. It's low at other times. And in some women, sexual desire and sexual activity is increased at the time when estrogen levels are high. On the other hand, there are certainly other women who find that their peak sexual activity occurs around the time of menstruation when estrogen levels are at their lowest. This may be the result of knowing that they cannot get pregnant at that time.
That was Diane Suter, Associate Professor of Biology at Loyola University Chicago. You also heard from Midge Wilson, Professor of Psychology at DePaul University. That's going to do it for us for today. Thanks to Carol Frieders and Mike Gilmore for engineering. Thanks to Joshua Andrews for producing and directing. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to look ahead a bit to the future of recorded music. There have been some recent changes in the structure of the music biz. What influence might that have on the music you hear in the future, where you'll hear it, how you'll hear it, and how much people will be paid in order for you to hear it. Also, don't forget, Thursday, astronomer Doug Duncan will be on, so tune in for that. And Friday is Film Forum, and we'll be talking about the films of Pedro Almodovar. So tune in for all of that. Just don't change the radio dial at all. This is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to WBEZ Chicago.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore. When the world seems to shine like you've had too much wine. That's amore. Bells will ring, ting-a-ling-a-ling, ting-a-ling-a-ling, and you'll sing Vita Bella. Hearts will play, tippy-tippy-tay, tippy-tippy-tay, like a guitarandella. When the stars make you drool, just like a pastifazool, that's amore. When you dance, dance.
I don't know anything about love.
On the next Fresh Air, in celebration of Valentine's Day, 69 love songs, a triple CD of love songs about love songs. We'll talk to the composer, Stephen Merritt. 69 love songs topped our rock critic Ken Tucker's list of the best CDs of 1999. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air comes your way weekdays at 2 o'clock on WBEZ Chicago.
On Valentine's Day, Elvis Costello gets together with Rodgers and Hart.
My funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile with my heart.
I'm Noah Adams. Later today, the story behind My Funny Valentine and the day's news on NPR's All Things Considered.
Between 3 and 6:30 on WBEZ Chicago.
It's award-winning music all this month here on WBEZ. From this year's Grammy nominees, as well as past winners, to various polls, competitions, honorary degrees, and other prizes and honors given to music and musicians down through the years. The music begins weeknights at 8, and you can hear all the award-winning sounds right here at 91.5 FM, WBEZ Chicago.
And coming up next on WBEZ Chicago is Worldview. I'm Jerome McDonnell, and today we'll be talking about the U.S. aid package to Colombia. Debate is expected to begin on the package on Capitol Hill this week, and we'll talk with Ambassador Robert Wright, and we'll also talk with a member of the State Department about that package. Miloš Stalik is going to check in from the 50th Berlin International Film Festival, and we're going to talk about Zimbabwe today and the constitutional referendum that they held over the weekend. So stay tuned for this coming up right after the BBC News here on WBEZ Chicago.
18 hours Greenwich Mean Time. BBC World Service, the news with Eileen McHugh. Austria has made an appeal to the European Union for an end to its diplomatic isolation. Afghan passengers hijacked to Britain over a week ago have been giving details of their ordeal. An American spacecraft has made contact with an asteroid and successfully gone into orbit around it. And the French government has announced plans to stop what it called a slave trade in young footballers from Africa. Austria has made a formal appeal to the European Union for an end to its diplomatic isolation following the inclusion of the far-right Freedom Party in a new coalition government in Vienna. At a meeting of foreign ministers in Brussels, Austria's representative